For this Wednesday, August the 5th, this is Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio. I'm Steve Scully. Here are some of your headlines. The Biden campaign announcing today that this month's Democratic National Convention will be entirely virtual. Presumptive nominee Joe Biden will not travel to Milwaukee. Instead, he will accept the nomination from his home state of Delaware. It comes as the country continues to reel from COVID-19. The number of cases in the U.S. quickly approaching 4.8 million. The death toll here in the U.S. has now surpassed 157,000. This pandemic affecting the college fall football schedule, with UConn canceling its entire season. In the country's third largest district, Chicago Public Schools will now begin the school year fully remote. The move leaves New York City as the only major U.S. school district still planning to offer at least some in-person classes in the fall. And travelers from 35 states now required to quarantine for 14 days when they travel to New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut. And the mayor of New York announcing that the city will be setting up a bridge and tunnel checkpoint to enforce the quarantine order. The story shaping Washington today, it's all ahead on C-SPAN Radio. We begin with Campaign 2020 and some major developments regarding the upcoming party conventions. The White House now indicating that President Trump may accept his party's nomination with a speech on the South Lawn at the White House. Speaker Nancy Pelosi saying that that idea degrades the White House and serves as yet another diversion from this coronavirus pandemic. Her comments on MSNBC earlier today.
We're all learning this at the same time now, that he won't be there. But I think it's an indication of the seriousness with which she judges the situation. This pandemic is dangerous, and the increase in numbers just demands that we keep our distances. I commend him for doing that. It's going to be a great convention. People will see it virtually, and we're very proud of him. I think it's a great thing that he's doing this early enough so the rest of us now are told that we're not coming either, I guess. And we can all make our plans from around the country for a great American victory for Joe Biden as he is nominated for president.
I also want to ask you about our reporting that the Republicans are also planning not to have the president leave Washington for his acceptance speech. But most interestingly, he has floated the idea today of doing it on the South Lawn of the White House. Our reporting is also that he has suggested monuments as a backdrop, like the Lincoln Memorial. Is that appropriate? I'm not sure if there's a law against it, but there certainly is a tradition. You don't use the White House as the backdrop for any politics. He has broken that with the Rose Garden and other events before, but the acceptance for the Republican nomination coming with the White House as the backdrop, does that strike you as wrong?
Yeah, it's very wrong. Again, when we're in the Capitol of the United States under the dome, we have a very limited opportunity to reference anything political. And for the President of the United States to degrade once again the White House, as he has done over and over again, by saying he's going to completely politicize it, is something that should be rejected right out of hand. It's, again, notion-mongering, not serious thinking. And it won't happen. Let's put it that way. Whether it's legally wrong or ethically out of the question, it shouldn't even been something that was expressed.
That from House Speaker Nancy Pelosi on MSNBC earlier today with Andrea Mitchell. This headline from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel on the Democratic Convention, Milwaukee's disappearing convention, as Biden and other speakers now not traveling to that city. And this other headline for Milwaukee businesses, the 2020 DNC is a tale of dashed dreams. We'll have more on that story in just a moment. But first, going back to the president, well, Bloomberg News is reporting that the president's idea to give his nomination acceptance speech from the South Lawn at the White House may be legal for him, but it lays out a minefield of problems for the staff charged with putting such an event together. Legal experts saying that the White House staff would violate the federal Hatch Act by planning or participating in such an event. The Hatch Act does bar U.S. government employees from conducting any political activities during work hours while in a government building or while wearing a government uniform. The president and the vice president, they're exempt from the law, but everyone else who works at the White House, from the chief of staff to the groundskeepers and the event planners, they are not. More details at Bloomberg.com. And on Capitol Hill, this reaction from Utah Republican Senator and 2012 GOP nominee Mitt Romney.
What do you think about the president suggesting that he may have a convention speech at the White House?
I don't know whether that's technically legal or not, but it's got to be somewhere.
So you'd be okay with it if it...
Bill Glauber covers politics for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He is joining us from Milwaukee. Bottom line, what does this now mean for the city?
Nothing. There will be very little taking place here. It'll be just another day in the life of Milwaukee. All the hopes and dreams of a convention that was going to draw 50,000 people. There was a drip, drip, drip as the thing went down the drain, and now it's a virtual event.
You have been covering this story for the last 2 years with a lot of anticipation and expectation of what it would mean for Milwaukee and for Wisconsin in general. Walk us through this story as it's unfolded.
Well, it started in February of 2018 when a local bid committee got together and people said, really? Seriously? And then you thought about it and, you know, Wisconsin, a pivotal state, they had some money behind them and you thought, yeah, this could happen. And, you know, we went through that bid process, watched it, observed it, and it became pretty clear that Milwaukee was the odds-on favorite. It was a finalist city along with Miami and Houston. And then in March of 2019, it was awarded the event. It would have been the biggest event in the city's history. There was a lot of anticipation, and right now, obviously, a lot of heartache.
And what about the financial loss for the city? Because I imagine Milwaukee had to put up a fair amount of money.
Well, actually, no. Milwaukee technically didn't have to put up a fair amount of money. You know, they privately raised money for the bid. And then they were funding the convention through donations from corporations. But the city itself was not on the hook for this. There was also a federal grant for money. So in terms of the financial loss for the city, it's not a big revenue loss in terms of, you know, what you spent. The big loss, however, though, is the anticipated revenue that was going to come in. You know, they were saying upwards to $200 million, you know, in tourist dollars. You can take that with a grain of salt. But this was going to be a very big event for this city.
And so now it is a completely virtual event. What's the sense in the city? What are your colleagues telling you? How do you feel? And those that you're talking to?
Well, I think you could see this coming for quite a while. You know, the convention was shrinking slowly but surely for the last few months as the coronavirus pandemic, took its hold on the United States and the world. So, you know, people were pretty much resolved to a small-scale event. And this obviously is even smaller, and it calls into question in terms of the future of these political conventions. You know, you have the Republicans who were, ping-ponging between cities. You have the Democrats trying to keep this together here, not working. It kind of reminds me of the Olympic movement, the Olympic Games in the late 70s and early 80s with the tit-for-tat boycotts and, that thing almost went away, and then L.A. happened in 1984, and it was revived. But, you have to wonder what would revive a political convention, really a 19th century thing in the 21st century.
So you think this is a transformational moment. Do you think Milwaukee would even bid for the convention in 4 years?
That's a good question. I don't know. I can't imagine a lot of cities would be bidding on a convention in 2024, but things change. You know, of course, with the Republican convention, I believe only one city, Charlotte, North Carolina, ultimately bid for the event. And, it's going to be tough, I think, to line up cities. Obviously, some city will want it, but, you know, the days where you saw this as a cash cow and a great thing, I think, you know, people will have to sort of reassess and, you know, what it is they want out of these conventions, both the political parties and the potential bid cities.
Bill Glauber covers politics for the Journal Sentinel. He is joining us in Milwaukee. Thank you for being with us.
Thanks so much.
Also today, the Trump campaign suing Nevada to block that state's plan to expand mail-in voting. It comes one day after the president praised Florida for its mail-in voting program. And in this CBS News interview, former Vice President Joe Biden was asked about his cognitive skills. Here is reporter Errol Barnett.
Mr. Vice President, your opponent in this election, President Trump, has made your mental state a campaign topic. And when asked in June if you'd been tested for cognitive decline, you've responded that you're constantly tested in effect because you're in situations like this on the campaign trail. But please clarify specifically, have you taken a cognitive
test? No, I haven't taken a test. Why the hell would I take a test? Come on, man. That's like saying you, before you got in this program, you take a test where you're taking cocaine or not. What do you think, huh? Are you a junkie?
What do you say to President Trump, who brags about his test and makes your mental state an issue for voters?
Well, if he can't figure out the difference between an elephant and a lion, I don't know what the hell he's talking about. Did you watch that? Look, come on, man. I know you're trying to goad me, but I mean, I'm so forward looking to have an opportunity to sit with the president or stand with the president in debates. There can be plenty of time. And by the way, as I joke with him, you know, I shouldn't say it. I'm going to say something I probably shouldn't say. Anyway, I am very willing to let the American public judge my physical and mental fitness. And to make a judgment about who I am.
That interview available at CBSNews.com. Joe Biden on his cognitive skills. And the president this morning calling for the first presidential debate to be moved up, citing increased mail-in and early voting that will see many ballots cast before the first debate is even held. For example, in the swing state of Michigan, absentee ballots can be cast 45 days before the November 3rd election. In Virginia, in-person voting also begins early. And in Minnesota, in-person voting begins on September the 18th. So the first debate, scheduled for September 29th, two others in October, the VP debate scheduled for October 7th in Salt Lake City. Here's the president on Fox News this morning.
Joe Biden was interviewed yesterday by Dana Perino, and she said that Joe Biden will be debating you in those three debates. He's already committed to that. But then you have people with the New York Times, Joe Lockhart, suggesting that Biden not debate you. You have others saying that all of a sudden it's not an accurate forum and they're not in favor of these debates. Why do you think that is?
Well, they're trying to get out. I mean, my people are telling me that they're playing very cute. They're trying to get out. There's no question about that. But, you know, we should have the debates. The one problem I have, the debate's very late. It's at the end of September, and a lot of ballots will already be cast by that time. They want to make the debates as late as possible. And, you know, this commission, they've already apologized to me for what they did. They were oscillating my mic during one debate. They've actually apologized, if you can believe it. I have it in writing that they were doing it, what they do. And this is a commission that's a very left-leaning commission. I frankly wouldn't have even used it, and I could have done that, except it's been used for years. But this is a Clinton, Obama-type commission, and, you know, they call it, it's a beautiful name, but I'm not happy with it. But why are they putting the first debate so late? The first debate should be before the first, at least before the first ballots go out, and they have it a month later, almost a month later. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, September 29th in Ohio.
Regardless what it is, I'm ready to debate. I don't care. I hear he wants to get out, but he has, in all fairness to him, he has not said that.
The president on Fox and Friends earlier today. By the way, the historian who has correctly predicted every election since 1984, including Donald Trump's win in 2016, has announced his pick for 2020. It is Democrat Joe Biden. Alan Lichtman is an author, a history professor at American University here in Washington. He revealed his prediction in an op-ed video posted this morning on the New York Times website. Here's a portion.
Alan Lichtman is certain we've been thinking about elections all wrong.
The pollsters and the pundits cover elections as though they were horse races. But history tells us voters are not fooled by the tricks of the campaign. Voters vote pragmatically according to how well the party holding the White House has governed the country.
So polls are worthless?
They are snapshots in time. None of this, in the end, has any impact whatsoever on the outcome of a presidential election.
The view of Alan Lichtman, the full 7-minute video, it's been posted at nytimes.com. Meanwhile, the Trump and the Biden campaigns out with a new set of ads today.
Deep in the heart of Delaware, Joe Biden sits in his basement, alone, hiding, diminished, refusing to answer questions about the crazy far-left ideas he's adopted. a massive tax increase, allowing China and Mexico to steal our jobs. Amnesty for illegal immigrants, letting them compete for American jobs. Biden has no answers. And after five decades of failure, he never will.
I'm Donald J. Trump, and I approve this message. I think it's under control. I'll tell you what.
How? 1,000 Americans are dying a day.
They are dying. That's true. And you have, it is what it is. It is what it is. It is what it is. It is what it is.
Campaign 2020, over the airwaves. And the Lincoln Project, a group of Republicans opposed to the president's reelection, out with this new ad titled Secretary of Failure.
President Trump gives lots of jobs to his son-in-law, Jared Kushner. Insiders whisper he may be even more powerful than Trump. But like his father-in-law, Jared's not up to the task. This pampered princeling has never met a problem he couldn't f*** up. Take the COVID response Trump assigned Jared to handle. 150,000 people dead and an economy in ruins.
But by July, the country's really rocking again.
His task force put Trump cronies first. And of course, Jared's family cashed in on bailout money. No surprise from the son of a convicted felon and slumlord who served time in prison. Jared's a perfect fit for this White House. But if you've ever wondered whether this president took COVID-19 seriously, look no further than who he put in charge of protecting America's health. Jared Kushner, Trump's Secretary of Failure. The Lincoln Project is responsible for the content of this advertising.
And of course, be sure to follow the events of Campaign 2020. It's all on our website at cspan.org. On Wall Street today, the S&P closed higher for a fourth day, gaining 21 points. The Dow jumping more than 300 points. The Nasdaq rose 57. In other money news, for the first time in its nearly 170-year history, the New York Times making more money from its digital products than it did from its print newspaper during the three-month quarterly earnings. Those earnings posted today. And good news for U.S. auto sales, which have bounced back in recent months despite the coronavirus pandemic, with CNBC reporting that some brands even seeing their sales increase over last year's numbers at this point last year. You're listening to Washington Today. This is Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio, but also available as a podcast. And here are some of your other headlines. The CDC today issuing a health warning against the ingestion of alcohol-based hand sanitizer products following reports of poisonings here in the U.S. The agency is saying that poison centers, for example, in Arizona and New Mexico, reporting 15 cases of methanol poisoning associated with the swallowing of hand sanitizers. Four of the patients who were hospitalized died. Meanwhile, in a new episode of her podcast, former First Lady Michelle Obama acknowledging that she is, quote, dealing with some form of low-grade depression this year, adding not just because of the quarantine, but because of the racial strife and just seeing this administration watching the hypocrisy of it day in and day out, calling it dispiriting. And at the White House, the current First Lady, Melania Trump, overseeing Rose Garden renovations with new lighting, new flowers, and draining improvements. That work is now underway this week, expected to be finished later this summer. Now to today's Senate Judiciary Committee hearing and the testimony of former Deputy Attorney General, Acting Attorney General at one point, Sally Yates. She defended the Justice Department's investigation into one-time Trump national security aide, Michael Flynn, telling lawmakers that Flynn was essentially neutering American sanctions and also undercutting the Obama administration by, quote, making nice with a foreign adversary after allegations that Russia did interfere in the 2016 election. Sally Yates telling the committee that Michael Flynn's lies to the FBI were, quote, absolutely material to a legitimate investigation. She, by the way, has been a prosecutor for nearly 30 years. She called the effort to drop the prosecution against a defendant who twice pleaded guilty as something that is highly irregular. More from today's hearing.
Chairman Graham, you have indicated that you are particularly interested in the meeting that occurred in the Oval Office on January 5th, 2017. And can you all hear me okay now?
Much better.
Right. So why don't I just go directly to that? This meeting took place just 2 months after the 2016 election. And this was at a time when we were just beginning to come to terms with a foreign adversary's stunning systematic attack on our democracy. You know, we've all heard Russian interference in our election so much that it's kind of lost its shock value. But this attack on our homeland was indeed shocking. By late December, our intelligence community had determined that Russia, acting on the direct orders of President Vladimir Putin, had engaged in a massive effort to undermine faith in our democratic processes, to hurt Hillary Clinton's chance of electability, and to aid the candidacy of now President Donald Trump. The Russian government had used cyber attacks, the strategic release of stolen information, and a coordinated campaign to weaponize social media against American citizens. This unprecedented act of aggression could not go unanswered. So on December 28th, the Obama administration took a first step by ejecting 35 suspected Russian intelligence operatives and imposing other sanctions on Russia. They did this both to punish the Russians for their attack on our democracy and, importantly, to deter them from ever doing it again. As expected, the Russians immediately announced that they would retaliate. But then the next day, they inexplicably reversed course and announced that they didn't intend to take any responsive action. The administration was understandably perplexed by this abrupt change, and President Obama asked the intel community to try to figure out what had happened. And the FBI discovered the answer. General Michael Flynn, the incoming National Security Advisor, was having back-channel discussions with Russian Ambassador Sergei Kislyak. Recorded conversations between General Flynn and the ambassador revealed that General Flynn had essentially neutered the U.S. government's message of deterrence.
That from today's Senate Judiciary Committee hearing held virtually. And at one point during the hearing, there was this exchange before Sally Yates, who did serve as the former acting attorney general for a while, and two committee members, Chairman Lindsey Graham, Republican of South Carolina, and Senator Patrick Leahy, Democrat of Vermont.
Does it bother you that the FISA court rebuked the Department of Justice and the FBI regarding the Carter Page warrant application?
Senator, I believe that the Department of Justice and the FBI have a duty of candor with the FISA court.
Do you believe they fulfilled that duty?
No, I do not believe that they did. I think that there were.
As a matter of fact, you signed that warrant application in October and January, is that correct?
That's right.
Knowing then what you know now, would you sign that application?
Senator, I would never sign any document.
So I take that to be no, because that document was a fraud. Is that a fair statement? If you knew then what you know now, you wouldn't have signed it?
I wouldn't sign anything that I knew to contain errors or omissions.
Well, did that contain errors and omissions?
Yeah, and I would never knowingly sign a document. Right. I didn't do that in the 27 years.
I believe you didn't know that what you signed was wrong. The question is, if you had known, you wouldn't have signed it. Is that correct?
No, if I had known that it contained incorrect information, I certainly wouldn't have signed it.
Thank you. And do you agree with me it did contain incorrect information?
I know that now based on the Horowitz report.
That's all I'm trying to say. I'm not saying that you lied to the court. I'm saying you signed something that was a lie and you didn't know it. Now, let's talk about a January 5th meeting. Was the vice president there?
Yes, he was.
Okay. Did he mention the Logan Act?
You know, I don't remember the vice president saying much of anything in this meeting.
So you don't remember him mentioning the Logan Act?
No, I don't.
Did anybody mention the Logan Act?
I have a vague memory of Director Comey mentioning the Logan Act.
Okay, what was he mentioning the Logan Act about? In what context?
I'm not sure if he mentioned that in the Oval Office meeting or in the meeting that
what do you think about the...
Mr. Chairman, let her answer the question. Just because it's a woman testifying doesn't mean she has to be cut off.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Senator Lee. I really appreciate that. You're very constructive. So here's my question. Was the Logan Act mentioned in the meeting?
I recall direct Comey mentioning it at some point. What I'm not sure about, Senator Graham, and I want to be
That's fair. That's fair. You don't know if it's mentioned in the meeting or not. Do you believe
I do recall Director Comey mentioning it at some point. I'm not sure.
Right. No, I got you. I got you.
Or in the discussion he and I had.
No, I got you.
That's all I'm trying.
That with Senator Lindsey Graham, a brief comment by Senator Patrick Leahy and Sally Yates before the Senate Judiciary Committee. As way of background, the Logan Act is a U.S. federal law that criminalizes negotiations by any unauthorized American citizen with foreign governments that may have a dispute with the U.S. And it dates back to 1799 in the Fifth Congress of the United States. In Beirut, residents there today demanding accountability for the mishandling of explosive material that detonated, killing more than 100 people. An estimated 300,000 people are displaced from their homes. Lebanon's health minister saying that they are still trying to account for some of the missing. 5,000 were wounded. The blast so powerful it could be felt more than 150 miles away, leveling entire sections of the city of Beirut near the port, leaving nothing but twisted metal and debris for blocks. The waterfront neighborhood, for example, normally full of restaurants and nightclubs, essentially flattened. And the country is now in a two-week state of emergency. On Capitol Hill, it is day 10 of the negotiations between Democrats and Republicans. Senator Chuck Schumer telling reporters late yesterday that both sides are making concessions, with another round of talks that took place earlier today between congressional Democrats and the Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin and White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows. Senate Republicans offering to extend additional unemployment benefits at $200 per week, and now the Trump administration reportedly offering to double that to $400 a week, but Democrats want to keep it at $600 per week. Secretary Mnuchin is also offering to extend a moratorium on evictions from federally backed housing into December. Democrats also cutting their request for additional funds to the U.S. Postal Service, initially asking for $25 billion, now reducing that to $10 billion. And so while the negotiations continue behind closed doors, on the Senate floor, these comments, first from Democrat Dick Durbin of Illinois.
Senator Schumer and Speaker Pelosi, who are sitting in the room day after day after day, trying to hammer out an agreement to help America in this time of need, while there are two empty chairs at the table. Kevin McCarthy, the House Republican leader, does not attend the meetings. And sadly, the Republican leader of the United States Senate is also boycotting these meetings. I can't remember a time when this has occurred, ever. No time in history when there was a critical national decision to be hammered out between the parties and the leaders of the Republican Party in Congress refused to attend the meetings. Senator McConnell gives polished speeches on the floor criticizing Senator Schumer and Speaker Pelosi. They should be polished. He has time to practice them all day instead of going into the negotiations, which could actually make a difference in the future of America. Americans are genuinely concerned, and they should be. We face a national health emergency. This pandemic, sadly, where the infections are spiking across America. It is still amazing to consider two numbers, the number five. The United States has about 5% of the world's population. 25. The United States has generated 25% of the COVID infections in the world. 5% of the population, 25% of the reported COVID infections in the world. How did we reach this point where this great, developed, civilized, and strong nation has been brought to its knees by this pandemic? We reached this point by lack of leadership. The American people know that there has been leadership failures at the top.
And that's from Senator Dick Durbin. Meanwhile, the AP is reporting that a group of 16 Republican senators endorsing a plan to give more money to the airline industry hit particularly hard by the layoffs. The plan would provide as much as $25 billion for America's passenger airlines. It appears likely that Congress will have to approve a bill with largely Democratic votes in both the GOP-controlled Senate and the Democratic-controlled House, as you heard just a moment ago from Senator Dick Durbin. The Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell acknowledging yesterday today that his caucus, quote, has divisions about what to do and on the issue of extending unemployment insurance. He indicated that he is prepared to support the deal that the Democrats and the White House strike, even, as he put it, if he has problems with certain parts of it. The House and Senate right now scheduled to leave town at the end of this week, but of course the calendar remains fluid. More from the Senate floor with Republican John Thune of South Dakota.
A senior correspondent for CNN talked to Speaker Pelosi yesterday, who claimed she wanted to reach agreement on a bill this week. The correspondent asked the speaker what price tag she was willing to agree to. Her answer, $3.4 trillion. In other words, Mr. President, after more than a week of negotiations, the Speaker of the House hasn't budged from her original position. She hasn't budged. Nor have the Senate Democrats, who every time something has come up on our side to try and address this crisis, have answered with, well, let's just pass the HEROES Act of the House, the $3.4 trillion boondoggle. Well, Mr. President, that's not a compromise. That's not a negotiation. And if we emerge from this process without a coronavirus relief bill, the responsibility will rest squarely on the shoulders of the Democrat leadership. Well, let's suppose for a moment that Republican negotiators agreed to every single thing that Democrats are insisting on. Tax cuts for millionaires, diversity studies for the marijuana industry, a $1 trillion pot of money for states, who, I might add, haven't even come close to spending the coronavirus money the government has already given them. Let's suppose Republican negotiators agreed to everything. What would happen then? Well, Mr. President, the bill would never pass the Senate. In the Senate, you need 60 votes to pass a bill. And there simply aren't 60 votes in the Senate for the Democrats' liberal fantasies. In fact, Mr. President, it would be lovely if, as Democrats seem to think, the government drew its funding from a magical pot of gold that never runs out. But it doesn't. Every dollar of the coronavirus relief that we've already provided has been borrowed money, which continues to drive up our national debt. Now, arguably, it was money that needed to be borrowed. But, Mr. President, there has to be a limit. The higher we drive our national debt, the greater the danger to the health of our economy. Democrats may be fine with jeopardizing our economic health to pay for diversity studies in the marijuana industry, but I can tell you the Republicans are not. Republicans know that we're going to have to borrow some additional money to meet the demands of the coronavirus crisis. And we have offered legislation to do just that. But we are not going to further endanger our already battered economy by signing off on every unnecessary spending item on the Democrats' liberal fantasy list.
From the Senate floor earlier today, Republican John Thune of South Dakota. Meanwhile, in the House of Representatives, this headline at Axios.com, inside Republican leader Kevin McCarthy's new GOP messaging platform. Joining us on the phone is Alana Treen. What can you tell us?
So, yes, House Republican leader Kevin McCarthy has given his colleagues basically marching orders for what their stump speeches should look like between now and November. And this comes, of course, as incumbents are worrying about President Trump's own challenges as they head into November.
What is the messaging and how is he doing this? I know in your story you point out the PowerPoint presentation that he delivered last week to key colleagues.
Yeah, so he delivered this presentation in the Capitol Visitor Center last week. Most Republican members of the House joined either in person or via Zoom. But the plan really highlights what McCarthy describes as three R's, and he says that they should exhaust this on a campaign trail. The three R's are renew, restore, and rebuild. Renew the American dream, and there are some topics that he suggested could fall under there, including school choice, expanding broadband into rural areas, protecting individual freedoms, restore the way of life. So that's more focused on defeating the coronavirus, protecting Americans' health, ensuring neighborhoods are safe. And then the last are rebuilding the economy. tax deregulation is some examples that he brought up, a China critical messaging around supply chains. So those are the three things that he said that Republicans should highlight. He also said that with that, there's three D's that they should, you know, be ascribing to the Democrats, and those are defund, dismantle, and destroy, which he says is defund the police and border patrol and military, dismantling socioeconomic and political institutions, and what they argue are Democrats destroying small businesses and entrepreneurs with what they say are crushing taxes and regulations.
And of course, these Republicans looking at the polling numbers for the president, a Gallup survey that says only 14% of those questioned say the country is moving in a positive direction. So do they feel this is an uphill battle as they try to recapture the House of Representatives in an election year where Donald Trump is at the top of the ticket?
It's definitely an uphill battle. I don't think any Republican would deny that, especially privately. I know in my conversations with lawmakers, you know, behind the scenes, they all are definitely worried about what will happen. And it is going to be a tough election for President Trump. And of course, that will always affect the down ballot candidates. And so this messaging is really trying to make sure that the GOP party is united in what they're saying and in their messaging, and that they also have some sort of idea of what the agenda would look like if they do take back the House and if President Trump does have a second term. And that's key here, because I know that a lot of Republican lawmakers told Leader McCarthy that they were concerned when President Trump failed to have a good answer on what a second term would look like. So this is kind of laying out those topic areas, what they're going to be staying on their campaign trails, and just trying to give them a really detailed look at what they should be rolling out on their own.
More details at axios.com. We thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
And finally, this late update from Capitol Hill, where Nancy Pelosi, the House Speaker, again talking about negotiations with the White House and congressional Republicans. The House plan is about $3.4 trillion. The Senate Republican plan is about $1 trillion. Negotiations continue. Friday now appears to be the deadline for any agreement. More from Capitol Hill with the Speaker.
As we come together here in the Capitol, American people, among American people are many millions of children who are food insecure, many families who are concerned about being evicted, tens of millions of people who are on unemployment insurance. We have to come to an agreement that meets the needs of the American people. That is the standard. This is an unusual negotiation, as I've said before, because people are dying. And so there's an urgency and a value that we have to address that is in the here and now. And so time is of the essence. The leader and I are determined that we will come to agreement, but it has to meet the needs of the American people. That is our purpose here. And it has to be done in a timely fashion, because that is what is happening. That we've got to end the virus so we can open our schools and open our economy. We've got to help state and local governments so they can meet the needs of people. And we have to put money in the pockets of the American people so that they can stimulate the economy, spend the money, inject demand, and the rest. And we have to do it in a way that is respectful and not disdainful of America's working families, as if we have to subject any dollar they receive to a scrutiny that we would never give to some big tax break for wealthy individuals. So this is the challenge that we have. And again, it is about some issues that are important to us that are not big dollar figures, but are important to us, and that is honoring our responsibilities to American people in terms of the postal system, motherhood, apple pie, the postal system, all-American system, as well as how that has an impact on the life of our democracy. So our the lives, the livelihood, and the life of our democracy. That is what we are having a discussion about, and I feel optimistic that there is a light at the end of the tunnel. But how long that tunnel is remains to be seen.
That late update on Capitol Hill with House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. By the way, we did not hear from either Secretary Mnuchin or the White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows, although Mark Meadows did appear in an interview on CNN that's been posted at CNN.com. A reminder, this program, Washington Today, it's available wherever you get your podcasts or on our website at cspan.org/podcast. For this Wednesday, August the 5th, I'm Steve Scully in Washington. Thanks for joining us. Enjoy the rest of your evening.
C-SPAN's Washington Journal. Every day we're taking your calls live on the air on the news of the day, and we'll discuss policy issues that impact you. Coming up Thursday morning, we'll discuss the 75th anniversary of the U.S. bombings on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, Japan, with Pacific War historian Ian Toll and author of Twilight of the Gods, War in the Western Pacific, 1944 to 1945. Also joining us, Clifton Truman Daniel, grandson of former President Harry Truman. Watch C-SPAN's Washington Journal live at 7 Eastern Thursday morning. And be sure to join the discussion with your phone calls, Facebook comments, text messages, and tweets.